ambassador to hear the chief of Columbia's Continental Staff, William L. Shirer. We take you now to Berlin.
Hello, America. Hello, CBS. This is Berlin. The sands are running fast.
And hello. This is America, where the sands are also running fast. Let's check in at the front lines of the fight to save democracy.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you could please direct your attention out the right side of the aircraft. Air Force One is currently in international waters, for the first time in history, flying over the recently renamed Gulf of America.
That was Air Force One, flying over what Donald Trump now calls the Gulf of America. And this is America. I'm your host, Rachel Bitticoffer.
And I'm Aaron Murphy.
Welcome to the constitutional crisis. Everything, everywhere, all at once. But before we get to that, Aaron, hit us with the headlines.
On it, Doc, the Vatican says Trump's decision last week to unilaterally wipe out the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, will cause millions of deaths around the world, and hundreds of millions more will be forced into poverty. USAID accounts for 40% of the world's financial aid. The move, with no warning, left thousands of aid workers stranded across the globe and shut down critical relief operations. Even a federal judge appointed by Trump thought the move went over like, well, Rachel, a fart in the Sistine Chapel. Judge Carl Nichols temporarily blocked plans to give the boot to USAID staffers. And then Trump shocked the entire world again after inviting Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to the White House, where he suggested this as an actual solution to the crisis in the Middle East.
The U.S. will take over the Gaza Strip, and we will do a job with it, too. We'll own it and be responsible for dismantling all of the dangerous unexploded bombs and other weapons on the site, level the site and get rid of the destroyed buildings, level it out, create an economic development that will supply unlimited numbers of jobs and housing for the people of the area.
Well, what does that mean? For Donald Trump, Gaza is the Atlantic City of the Middle East.
We have an opportunity to do something that could be phenomenal. And I don't want to be cute, I don't want to be a wise guy, but the Riviera of the Middle East, this could be something that could be so bad, this could be so magnificent.
This even caught Bibi Netanyahu off guard. Rachel, needless to say, having the President of the United States declare plans for ethnic cleansing from the White House podium turned some heads.
Okay, I gotta jump in here, dude. When you listen to that clip, you know he has no fucking idea that the reason the entire Middle East conflict exists is because it's about that land, Aaron. Like, it's not just land. It's that land. That land is the holy land for three different major world religions. So you can't just send them somewhere else and call it a day.
Oh, I know. And unlike other wild things, Donald Trump says he's actually doubling down on this one with the understanding that millions of Palestinians who call Gaza home will just go somewhere else. You know, Rachel, I had some time off in Washington, D.C. and decided to drive up to Atlantic City a few years ago, and that place was a dump. So there were Trump signs all over the place, and things were falling apart, stained concrete. It was one of the saddest places I've ever been. And, if that's what he has in mind for Gaza, we'll see.
Yeah, I got to tell you, I mean, it's always astounding to me, as we were noting in the book, that, you know, your average Uber driver thinks of Donald Trump as a successful businessman. And the fact of the matter is, dude, that the guy bankrupted a casino. You know how much money a casino makes? Like the sports betting shit that's taken over? Like, they offer, hey, $5 and we'll give you $200 free to bet with, right? Because they know that they can get you in the door and hook you. They're going to make mad money. So how do you end up bankrupting a casino? It's just, we should have known then.
Yes, we should have. Well, speaking of dollars.
What about aluminum, sir?
Aluminum, too.
10%?
No, 25%.
Following through with more of his tariff threats, Trump announced a 25% tariff on steel and aluminum imports. So coming soon to a Bud Light can near you, higher prices. These tariffs will combine with the 10% tariffs Trump imposed on China last week, which is already having an impact on the stock market. So if you're in the market for a new appliance or a car, you may want to consider doing it now.
Yeah, I have to say, you know, MAGA boycotted Bud Light because it was too woke for them. Now it's going to be too expensive. Didn't Trump also try to ban the U.S. Postal Service from delivering packages from China?
Yeah, I guess we would have called that Trump's Temu ban.
Ah, yeah, don't forget, folks, you have branding work to do, right? Don't call them tariffs, call them Trump taxes. It's Trump's Temu ban. Remember, if you want people to be mad at the Republicans, you got to lead that horse right to the water. If you say government or Congress, they have no idea what the hell you're talking about. You got to be explicit.
In other legal news, federal court decisions are starting to flow in from the various blatantly illegal things Trump and his number one, Elon Musk, are doing. A second federal judge issued stays on Trump's efforts to end birthright citizenship. Another judge issued a stay on Elon's fork-in-the-road buyout of federal employees. And on Monday, another federal judge issued a second decision ordering the Trump administration to comply with his previous order to unfreeze federal spending. You tracking all of this? We're heading for a showdown between the courts and the Trump administration, which is what made this tweet from Vice President J.D. Vance so disturbing. He wrote, and I'm quoting here, "If a judge tried to tell a general how to conduct a military operation, that would be illegal. If a judge tried to command the attorney general and how to use her discretion as a prosecutor, that's also illegal. Judges aren't allowed to control the executive's legitimate power." End quote.
I did not see that coming. Listen, we're going to talk a little bit about this later, but I do want to say blowing off the federal courts would be a real tipping point, like a Rubicon we don't want to cross. So, you know, it's something to keep your eye on.
Well, and finally, when asked by Fox News's Bret Baier how long Americans will need to wait for Trump to keep his promise of lower prices, the president deflected.
So if all goes to plan, when do you think families would be able to feel prices going down, groceries, energy, or are you kind of saying to them, hang on, inflation may get worse until it gets better?
No, I think we're going to become a rich nation. Look, we're not that rich right now. We owe $36 trillion. That's because we let all these nations take advantage of us. Same thing, like $200 billion with Canada. We owe $300. We have a deficit with Mexico of $350 billion. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to let that happen.
That's right, Rachel. No answer. But Bud Light, eggs, aluminum foil for those hats. Something tells me prices aren't going to come down anytime soon, Rachel.
All righty. Let's kick off this episode with a look at the very deliberate strategy of overwhelming the American people with everything, everywhere, all at once. The news cycle is such a hurricane of big moves, crazy power grabs. Let's set the stage with a clip from Fox News this week. Remember, folks, this is the kind of news most Americans are getting.
And NBC News has this headline, Kaylee. "We are figuring it out. Democrats struggle to keep up with Trump's dizzying pace. They don't know where to look."
I bet they are, because Trump has done more executive orders in 10 days than most presidents, I think, if not all, have done in 100 years. So that is a dizzying pace.
Yeah, that was Donald Trump's former press secretary, Kayleigh McEnany. And she went on to criticize prominent Democrats for calling what we're experiencing a constitutional crisis. She says using language like that doesn't stick with voters. But Rachel, we use that quite a bit because it's true. So I'd love your thoughts on it.
I mean, number one, we don't know if language like that sticks with voters. I would assume that she's alluding to the efforts by Harris, Biden before her, to talk about Democratic crisis. And, you know, the fact of the matter is the campaign didn't run on Democratic crisis. We really don't know how people will respond to a word like constitutional crisis. But you got to call a fox, okay?
Yeah.
A ball is a ball, a strike is a strike, folks. And what we're going through right now is a constitutional crisis.
Well, and you know, one of the things we like to do on this podcast is talk about the similarities between what's happening now to what was happening in 1930s Germany, specifically Berlin. That was the callback to "This is Berlin" from William L. Shire. But Rachel, since you've been studying that, what stands out to you about the efforts by the Trump administration and its allies to basically say, nothing to see here, folks?
Yeah, I mean, what we're seeing is definitely classic gaslight from the administration. And, you know, here's the other thing that people probably aren't paying so much attention to is that, like, the point of Project 2025 and MAGA isn't just to take control of the government, get rid of the agencies that they think are too liberal or too woke, or, you know, get rid of purging the DEI language. Those are all objectives for sure, but they're not the point. The point is to control culture, okay? And I got to tell you, I've just about jumped out of my couch on Sunday, when it came across the wire. There's two things that happened. Number one, Donald Trump fired the archivist from our national archives. Okay, that's a person that he purged. Why do they want to have a partisan hack in control of the national archives, right? And then to double up on that, he also put out a tweet that that you could honestly lift from out of Hitler. It talks about how we're going to have a golden age of culture because he has purged out all the wokesters from the Kennedy Center board, okay? And put in, you know, I guess YMCA fans, right? Because, you know, he comes to Hollywood. Mm-hmm. You don't have a very large selection of teen fascism, right? But in any case, like, we're going to have a golden age of culture. And I just, when I tell people, listen, the comparisons and one of the reasons it might sound outlandish to compare what's happening here to Berlin or Germany in the 30s is because we really think about the Nazis at the end of their regime. Those last 4 years where they make world war, where they murder all the Jews. But there's another, you know, 8 years of regime before that. And in that part of the regime, it was about seizing control of culture, right? And that's why they made the Ministry of Truth and Propaganda. And it's just, it is crazy to watch in real time a fascist movement using the powers of government to purge culture that they find to be degenerate. And it absolutely hallmarks back to that.
Yeah, that stuff about the Kennedy Center is quite unsettling. And it looks like if you want tickets to the Kennedy Center now, line up to see what Kid Rock and the Village People. Well, I want to play, Rachel, a clip of longtime Democratic strategist James Carville. I'm sure most people know who we're talking about, but he was on a podcast a few days ago called Politicon. And let's play this clip.
We can find all the times earlier when I talked about Bannon saying flooding his own with shit. Well, we flooded with shit now. So when that happens, I hope we can like pick a unifying theme that the public will find to be credible. The Democrats will find to be really credible and excite them. And it has to be true. And all of the truth is this is a government by billionaires for billionaires of billionaires.
So what he's saying there is that the Democrats need to find an issue that will unite. What do you think that unifying theme might be?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to look at the Democrats right now and not see that they look rudderless, right? But I do want in their defense to be sure people understand that they are powerless. Like, it's not just a look this time. It's an actual thing. They don't control any of the levers of power in D.C. And not only do they not control it, they don't control it at the same time where the party that does control it is willing to crush minority dissent in every capacity they have. Right. In the House, you can't impeach Trump because what goes on the floor is determined by the House majority, not the minority folks. So Hakeem Jeffries, other than protesting a lot and maybe some sit-ins, there's nothing he can really do to gum up the works there. You know, the size of their tiny majority is probably a more effective tool than anything else that we have there. And in the Senate, you know, the tool that keeps the minority party from being walked over like they are in the House, in the Senate, is the filibuster. Now, I've said this before, but I'll remind folks, this first omnibus, big federal budget, Trump tax cut galore, whatever big, beautiful bill he's planning, that's not going to run up into the filibuster because it's going to be passed on reconciliation, which is what Joe Biden did in 2020, okay? But everything after that's going to be filibuster-like worthy. And the first time the filibuster comes up against MAGA, I don't see it surviving. And I'll tell you why. It's not just that these, you know, eight or so, you know, more moderate, kind of old school, you know, believed in the actual Constitution Republicans are going to be facing political damage, like a primary. They're looking at being, you know, put in prison, being joined in Trump's enemy list. They are looking at having MAGA, you know, coming out of their house, like, you know, standing in front of their house with AR-15s. That's the political environment of opposition now is very different. And, you know, I've been telling people since December, listen, I don't know what to tell you to do, because I know what to tell you to do in a democracy using the levers of democratic procedure and protection to protest. If we don't have that, you know, the resistance against an autocracy is very different. And, you know, that said, Carville's right. There's not a unifying message. I'm here to tell you, it doesn't matter what the Democrats do until middle America realizes there's a problem. And until today, they have no idea, dude. Like the, all the sickness in your stomach, that is not shared by the person that you're walking by at the mall, okay? Until economic pain wakes these people up or something, you know, very, very outlandish that they can't miss happens, we're really rudderless, because at this point, the resistance can't come from the Democratic left. It has to come from the center of America.
A proof point for me about voters not paying attention became really clear to me as this news was happening about developing Gaza and turning it into basically a big casino on the coast of the Mediterranean. And what really pissed me off, frankly, is where are all the people who protested the Biden administration for being allies with Israel and for Gaza getting bombed? I'm not going to diminish the anger that they may have felt toward that issue. I understand that. But now that Donald Trump literally said, we're going to level Gaza, he used the word level. Where are those people now? Where's the outrage? They wasted it, in my opinion, months ago.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'll tell you where they are, dude, and it's going to really piss you off. I shit you not, guys. Where are they? They were protesting the DNC, okay? Like, yes, like last week, protesting the DNC. I mean, it's performative. It's maddening, you know, online. Of course, I don't have a lot of fans in that movement because of my criticism of the anti-Semitic elements of it and the pro-terrorism elements, frankly, right? But, you know, I have a lot of people that I've seen tweets from, oh, you know, and they're still bitching about Joe Biden and Gaza, dude. I'm like, these motherfuckers could be sitting, they're going to be in mass deportation camps, Aaron, okay? Sitting there eating bread and water and pissing in a hole, and they're going to still be blaming Democrats. That's the answer there.
Okay, Rachel, let's spend a bit more time talking about the role of the independent judiciary, and especially the federal judges who are staying busier than us playing goalie right now. This week, you took to Twitter, we don't call it X in our America, and you wrote, this is going to create a real litmus test for the survival of our democracy. Let's get into that.
It is. It's a tipping point moment for our democracy, Aaron. And that's why, like, I went to my keyboard and I sent something out on the Cycle and Substack about this topic on Sunday, on Super Bowl Sunday, because it is so critical. And just so people understand, we have a court system in which the court reviews the actions of the legislative, executive, and states, frankly, but the two branches of government, and determines whether it is meeting constitutional and federal statutory law, right? It's called judicial review. And, you know, without having people accept the verdict of a court and then modify their behavior. And we've seen an example of this, right? In Rudy Giuliani, he gets hit with this massive defamation lawsuit for falsely accusing these two random election workers of, you know, sneaking hard drives when they had mints or whatever it was. And even after that, continues to defame her, right? And you see that with Donald Trump and E. Jean Carroll. So there's this predisposition already in MAGA, in this cult, to discount what the court says. And, you know, I think it's important for us to kind of talk about, you know, how the court system functions in our democracy and why it's so critical.
Over the weekend on Air Force One, on the way to the Super Bowl, Trump was asked how he could support first responders after pardoning violent January Sixers who physically and violently assaulted those first responders. And I want to play this clip because it's what the hive mind of MAGA America truly believes.
But you pardoned people who assaulted first responders.
No, I pardoned people that were assaulted themselves. They were assaulted by our government. I pardoned J6 people who were assaulted by our government. That's who assaulted, and they were treated unfairly. And what I did was a great thing for humanity. They were treated very, very unfairly. There's never been an incident like it.
So, Rachel, to the rest of us, this is a blatant attempt to rewrite history. We saw it unfold on live TV with our own eyes, and yet the administration would tell you something completely different. And this isn't the first time that strongmen leaders like Donald Trump have tried to do this in history.
No, in fact, I mean, again, you know, we get this parallels between Trump and Hitler are many. And one of the other ways that they are many is that they first try to seize total power through an insurrection. For Hitler, this was the Beer Hall Putsch in 1923. Okay. And then once, you know, 10 years later, they became all powerful imperial presidents. What they did was turn, you know, this really shameful moment that, you know, Hitler faced criminal penalties for in German history became a national holiday, a day of celebration. The victimhood flipped around and the people who tried to overturn the government and his push were the heroes, okay? And the people who tried to stop them were the bad guys. And it is crazy, but as you pointed out, like, this is what the MAGA hive mind truly believes. I think you could stick people onto a lie detector test about election fraud, about belief in that, a belief that they're the victims of January 6th, and people like Marjorie Taylor Greene would probably pass it, dude. Alrighty then, I want to close out talking about this imminent showdown between the courts and Orange Mussolini. But in order to do this, I'm going to go a little intro to American Gov just to make sure you all understand the role of the judiciary and how it came to be the last word legally, okay? In my poli-sci class, we teach this famous case, Marbury versus Madison. And in that case, the Supreme Court seems to interpret its constitutional role to be the back check on legality. It says they have the right to review the actions of legislative and the executive branch to make sure that those actions are constitutional. And so this concept becomes known in a textbook as judicial review, okay? And it is argued that the court awarded itself this power because if you go and look at Article 3 of the Constitution, which lays out the judiciary, you're going to find actually the founders were big into Congress. Article 1 is like pages and pages of shit. Article 2 is like half a page, and Article 3 is like three sentences.
Hmm.
It's like there will be a federal court system and Congress will set it up, basically, okay? So this idea of judicial review really comes back to that first Supreme Court case, Marbury versus Madison. And, you know, what we're seeing in this, you know, strategy and why I'm so worried about the fact that they're going to blow this last red line on ignoring the courts is because Project 2025, in its introduction, calls for them to do so. I just want to read this so you guys can understand. This comes right out of Project 2025. It's one of the first things I noticed when I got the manual from Heritage Foundation. This is what it says. It says, quote, "The next conservative president must possess the courage to relentlessly put the interest of the everyday American over the desires of the ruling elite. Their outrage cannot be prevented. It must simply be ignored. And it can be. The left derives its powers from the institutions they control. But those institutions are only powerful to the extent that constitutional officers surrender their own legitimate authority to them. A president who refuses to do so and uses his or her office to reimpose constitutional authority over federal policymaking can begin to correct decades of corruption and remove thousands of bureaucrats from the positions of public trust they have so long abused." And what that means in fifth grade language, folks, it says when the courts come back and say you can't do that, just ignore them. And when the left yells about that, just ignore them too. I mean, that's bad, right?
It's terrifying. It's terrifying.
It is terrifying. And listen, like, we're seeing, I see conservatives all the time throwing up this Jackson quote now, okay? Andrew Jackson, in a famous case ruled against him in the Supreme Court, he said, "John Marshall has made his decision. Now let him enforce it," right? So, like, what that means, and the reason why these conservative MAGA Nazis are all seizing on it, is that there is no enforcement mechanism. There is no Supreme Court military or police that goes and enforces the court orders. What enforces them is respect of the rule of law and that final judgment from the court and the willingness for the legislative and executive branch to curtail the activity that has been ruled illegal, okay? And, you know, if the Trump people decide not to do that, we're really in a pickle. I mean, there's one time in history where we have a similar situation. It was in the States. It was during the fight against segregation, the integration of Little Rock High School. And, you know, what Kennedy did to get the enforcement part of the court's decision to desegregate enacted, to allow the students to physically enter the building, is he nationalized the National Guard. And the National Guard took over and put in a subservient position state and local police that were helping the segregationist, okay? If he controls the federal government, he also controls the things that we would rely on to enforce a court decision. And that's why, you know, I wish that I had better news for people. My job is to tell you what you need to know, not what you want to know. And what you need to know is that this is going to be a major, major tipping point if they go past these court orders.
Yeah. Well, and it also a stark reminder that the right gets very sensitive when you use words like fascism. And then you look at stuff like this and it's plain as day to people who study history like we do.
Yeah. And, you know, to be clear, I mean, this is ongoing as we're recorded. We've had a U.S. District Court judge, John McConnell, who is one of the judges, had the case of the federal budget spending freeze, right, that they said that he rescinded, but they actually didn't. And most of these agencies are strapped right now. They have no money and they're frozen. And he had issued a stay last week that said, you know, you can't do that while this is litigated. You must unfreeze these funds. And they didn't listen to him. So as we record this, Judge McConnell's issued a second decision telling them that they have no choice but to observe the court order. And what they do from here is going to be very telling.
And that's why we have to take people like J.D. Vance very seriously when he tweets something like, well, let's go, you know. Well, as always, you can find Rachel at Twitter, at Rachel Bitticoffer. At Substack, we are at thecycle.substack.com. And to our paid subscribers, always thank you. Please share our work. And of course, our book is Hit 'em Where It Hurts, How to Save Democracy by Beating Republicans at Their Own Game. Thank you for checking out that website, by the way. It's hitemwhereithurts.com. Okay, Rachel, final word of advice for another tough week ahead.
Yeah, I think I'm going to reach back to another war correspondent that was also covering the Nazis back in the 30s and was a good friend of Bill Shire. They did a show together, actually, on the radio. And that is somebody you've probably heard of, Edward R. Murrow. Okay, this is what he said. He said, "No man can terrorize a whole nation unless we are all his accomplices." So what can we do, man? We got to try to get through this wall of apathy that is the American electorate. Do whatever you can to get people to wake up to what's happening as soon as possible.
You know, it's a tall order, but we have no choice. We're grateful that you're doing this fight with us.
I wouldn't have it any way. You guys are my ride or die, man, all the way together.